You must come every day and teach me the music. I will buy a mandolin as soon as business is better. It is good for my arm. The next day he borrows a phonograph from the concierge. You will please teach me to dance, Henry. My stomach is too big. I am hoping that he will buy a porterhouse steak someday so that I can say to him, "You will please bite it for me, Mr. Non-Entity. My teeth are not strong." As I said a moment ago, ever since my arrival, he has become extraordinarily meticulous. "Yesterday," he says, "you made three mistakes, Henry. First, you forgot to close the toilet door, and so all night it makes boom boom. Second, you left the kitchen window open, and so the window is cracked this morning. And you forgot to put out the milk bottle. Always you will put out the milk bottle, please, before you go to bed, and in the morning you will please bring in the bread." Every day his friend Kepi drops in to see if any visitors have arrived from India. He waits for Nanantati to go out, and then he scurries to the cupboard and devours the sticks of bread that are hidden away in a glass jar. The food is no good, he insists, but he puts it away like a rat. Kepi is a scrounger, a sort of human tick, who fastens himself to the hide of even the poorest compatriot. From Kepi's standpoint, they are all nabobs. For a Manila cheroot and the price of a drink, he will suck any Hindu's ass. A Hindu's, mind you, but not an Englishman's. He has the address of every whorehouse in Paris and the rates. Even from the 10-franc joints, he gets his little commission. And he knows the shortest way to any place you want to go. He will ask you first if you want to go by taxi. If you say no, he will suggest the bus. And if that is too high, then the streetcar or the metro. Or he will offer to walk you there and save a franc or two, knowing very well that it will be necessary to pass a tabac on the way, and that you will please be so good as to buy me a little cheroot. Kepi is interesting in a way, because he has absolutely no ambition except to get a fuck every night. Every penny he makes, and they are damned few, he squanders in the dance halls. He has a wife and 8 children in Bombay, but that does not prevent him from proposing marriage to any little femme de chambre who is stupid and credulous enough to be taken in by him. He has a little room on the Rue Condorcet, for which he pays 60 francs a month. He papered it all himself. Very proud of it, too. He uses violet-colored ink in his fountain pen because it lasts longer. He shines his own shoes, presses his own pants, does his own laundry. For a little cigar, a cheroot, if you please, he will escort you all over Paris. If you stop to look at a shirt or a collar button, his eyes flash. "Don't buy it here," he will say. "They ask too much. I will show you a cheaper place." And before you have time to think about it, he will whisk you away and deposit you before another show window where there are the same ties and shirts and collar buttons. Maybe it's the very same store, but you don't know the difference. When Kepi hears that you want to buy something, his soul becomes animated. He will ask you so many questions and drag you to so many places that you are bound to get thirsty and ask him to have a drink, whereupon you will discover to your amazement that you are again standing in a tabac, maybe the same tabac, and Kepi is saying again in that small, unctuous voice, "Will you please be so good as to buy me a little cheroot?" No matter what you propose doing, even if it's only to walk around the corner, Kepi will economize for you. Kepi will show you the shortest way, the cheapest place, the biggest dish, because whatever you have to do, you must pass a tabac, and whether there is a revolution or a lockout or a quarantine, Kepi must be at the Moulin Rouge or the Olympia or the Ange Rouge when the music strikes up. The other day he brought a book for me to read. It was about a famous suit between a holy man and the editor of an Indian paper. The editor, it seems, had openly accused the holy man of leading a scandalous life. He went further and accused the holy man of being diseased. Kepi says it must have been the great French pox, but Nanantati avers that it was the Japanese clap. For Nanantati, everything has to be a little exaggerated. "At any rate," says Nanantati cheerily, "you will please tell me what it says, Henry. I can't read the book. It hurts my arm." Then, by way of encouraging me, "It is a fine book about the fucking, Henry. Kepi has brought it for you. He thinks about nothing but the girls. So many girls he fucks. Just like Krishna. We don't believe in that business, Henry." A little later, he takes me upstairs to the attic, which is loaded down with tin cans and crap from India wrapped in burlap and firecracker paper. "Here is where I bring the girls," he says, and then rather wistfully, "I am not a very good fucker, Henry. I don't screw the girls anymore. I hold them in my arms, and I say the words. I like only to say the words now." It isn't necessary to listen any further. I know that he is going to tell me about his arm. I can see him lying there with that broken hinge dangling from the side of the bed. But to my surprise, he adds, I am no good for the fucking, Henry. I never was a very good fucker. My brother, he is good. 3 times a day, every day. And Kepi, he is good. Just like Krishna. His mind is fixed now on the fucking business. Downstairs, in the little room where he kneels before the open cabinet, he explains to me how it was when he was rich and his wife and the children were here. On holidays, he would take his wife to the House of All Nations and hire a room for the night. Every room was appointed in a different style. His wife liked it there very much. A wonderful place for the fucking, Henry. I know all the rooms. The walls of the little room in which we are sitting are crammed with photographs. Every branch of the family is represented. It is like a cross-section of the Indian Empire. For the most part, the members of this genealogical tree look like withered leaves. The women are frail, and they have a startled, frightened look in their eyes. The men have a keen, intelligent look, like educated chimpanzees. They are all there, about 90 of them, with their white bullocks, their dung cakes, their skinny legs, their old-fashioned spectacles. In the background, now and then, one catches a glimpse of the parched soil, of a crumbling pediment, of an idol with crooked arms, a sort of human centipede. There is something so fantastic, so incongruous about this gallery, that one is reminded inevitably of the great spawn of temples which stretch from the Himalayas to the tip of Ceylon. A vast jumble of architecture, staggering in beauty, and at the same time monstrous, hideously monstrous, because the fecundity which seethes and ferments in the myriad ramifications of design seems to have exhausted the very soil of India itself. Looking at the seething hive of figures which swarm the facades of the temples, one is overwhelmed by the potency of these dark, handsome peoples who mingled their mysterious streams in a sexual embrace that has lasted 30 centuries or more. These frail men and women with piercing eyes who stare out of the photographs seem like the emaciated shadows of those virile, massive figures who incarnated themselves in stone and fresco from one end of India to the other in order that the heroic myths of the races who here intermingled should remain forever entwined in the hearts of their countrymen. When I look at only a fragment of these spacious dreams of stone, these toppling, sluggish edifices studded with gems, coagulated with human sperm, I am overwhelmed by the dazzling splendor of those imaginative flights which enabled 500 million people of diverse origins to thus incarnate the most fugitive expressions of their longing. It is a strange, inexplicable medley of feelings which assails me now as Nanantati prattles on about the sister who died in childbirth. There she is on the wall, a frail, timid thing of 12 or 13, clinging to the arm of a dotard. At 10 years of age, she was given in wedlock to this old roué who had already buried 5 wives. She had 7 children, only one of whom survived her. She was given to the aged gorilla in order to keep the pearls in the family. As she was passing away, so Nanantati puts it, she whispered to the doctor, I am tired of this fucking. I don't want to fuck anymore, doctor. As he relates this to me, he scratches his head solemnly with his withered arm. The fucking business is bad, Henry, he says, but I will give you a word that will always make you lucky. You must say it every day, over and over. 1,000,000 times you must say it. It is the best word there is, Henry. Say it now. Uma harumuma. Uma rabu. No, Henry, like this. Uma harumuma. Uma mama boom. No, Henry, like this. But what with the murky light, the botchy print, the tattered cover, the jig-jagged page, the fumbling fingers, the fox-trotting fleas, the lie-abed lice, the scum on his tongue, the drop in his eye, the lump in his throat, the drink in his pottle, the itch in his palm, the wail of his wind, the grief from his breath, the fog of his brain fag, the tick of his conscience, the height of his rage, the gush of his fundament, the fire in his gorge, the tickle of his tail, the rats in his garret, the hullabaloo and the dust in his ears. Since it took him 1 month to steal a march, he was hard set to memorize more than 1 word a week. I suppose I would never have gotten out of Nanantati's clutches if fate hadn't intervened. One night, as luck would have it, Kepi asked me if I wouldn't take one of his clients to a whorehouse nearby. The young man had just come from India, and he had not very much money to spend. He was one of Gandhi's men, one of that little band who made the historic march to the sea during the salt trouble. A very gay disciple of Gandhi's, I must say, despite the vows of abstinence he had taken. Evidently, he hadn't looked at a woman for ages. It was all I could do to get him as far as the Rue La Ferrière. He was like a dog with his tongue hanging out, and a pompous, vain little devil to boot. He had decked himself out in a corduroy suit, a beret, a cane, a Windsor tie. He had bought himself 2 fountain pens, a Kodak, and some fancy underwear. The money he was spending was a gift from the merchants of Bombay. They were sending him to England to spread the gospel of Gandhi. Once inside Miss Hamilton's joint, he began to lose his sang-froid. When suddenly he found himself surrounded by a bevy of naked women, he looked at me in consternation. "Pick one out," I said. "You can have your choice." He had become so rattled that he could scarcely look at them. "You do it for me," he murmured, blushing violently. I looked them over coolly and picked out a plump young wench who seemed full of feathers. We sat down in the reception room and waited for the drinks. The madam wanted to know why I didn't take a girl also.
"Yes, you take one too," said the young Hindu. "I don't want to be alone with her."
So the girls were brought in again, and I chose one for myself, a rather tall, thin one with melancholy eyes. We were left alone, the 4 of us, in the reception room. After a few moments, my young Gandhi leans over and whispers something in my ear. "Sure, if you like her better, take her," I said. And so, rather awkwardly and considerably embarrassed, I explained to the girls that we would like to switch. I saw at once that we had made a faux pas, but by now my young friend had become gay and lecherous, and nothing would do but to get upstairs quickly and have it over with. We took adjoining rooms with a connecting door between. I think my companion had in mind to make another switch once he had satisfied his sharp, gnawing hunger. At any rate, no sooner had the girls left the room to prepare themselves than I hear him knocking on the door.
"Where is the toilet, please?" he asks.
Not thinking that it was anything serious, I urge him to do in the bidet. The girls return with towels in their hands. I hear him giggling in the next room. As I'm putting on my pants, suddenly I hear a commotion in the next room. The girl is bawling him out, calling him a pig, a dirty little pig. I can't imagine what he has done to warrant such an outburst. I'm standing there with 1 foot in my trousers, listening attentively. He's trying to explain to her in English, raising his voice louder and louder until it becomes a shriek. I hear a door slam, and in another moment the madam bursts into my room, her face as red as a beet, her arms gesticulating wildly.
"You ought to be ashamed of yourself," she screams, "bringing a man like that to my place. He's a barbarian. He's a pig. He's a..."
My companion is standing behind her in the doorway, a look of utmost discomfiture on his face. "What did you do?" I ask.
"What did he do?" yells the madam. "I'll show you. Come here."
And grabbing me by the arm, she drags me into the next room.
"There! There!"
she screams, pointing to the bidet.
"Come on, let's get out," says the Hindu boy. "Wait a minute. You can't get out as easily as all that."
The madam is standing by the bidet, fuming and spitting. The girls are standing there too, with towels in their hands. The 5 of us are standing there looking at the bidet. There are 2 enormous turds floating in the water. The madam bends down and puts a towel over it.
"Frightful! Frightful!" she wails. "Never have I seen anything like this. A pig! A dirty little pig!"
The Hindu boy looks at me reproachfully.
"You should have told me," he says. "I didn't know it wouldn't go down. I asked you where to go and you told me to use that."
He is almost in tears. Finally, the madam takes me to one side. She has become a little more reasonable now. After all, it was a mistake. Perhaps the gentleman would like to come downstairs and order another drink. For the girls. It was a great shock to the girls. They are not used to such things. And if the good gentleman will be so kind as to remember the femme de chambre, it is not so pretty for the femme de chambre, that mess, that ugly mess. She shrugs her shoulders and winks her eye. A lamentable incident, but an accident. If the gentleman will wait here a few moments, the maid will bring the drinks. Would the gentleman like to have some champagne, yes?
"I'd like to get out of here," says the Hindu boy, weakly.
"Don't feel so badly about it," says the madam. "It is all over now. Mistakes will happen sometimes. Next time you will ask for the toilet."
She goes on about the toilet, 1 on every floor, it seems, and a bathroom, too.
I have lots of English clients, she says. They are all gentlemen. The gentleman is a Hindu. Charming people, the Hindus. So intelligent. So handsome.
When we get into the street, the charming young gentleman is almost weeping. He is sorry now that he bought a corduroy suit and the cane and the fountain pens. He talks about the 8 vows that he took, the control of the palate, etc. On the march to Dundee, even a plate of ice cream it was forbidden to take. He tells me about the spinning wheel, how the little band of Satyagrahists imitated the devotion of their master. He relates with pride how he walked beside the master and conversed with him. I have the illusion of being in the presence of one of the 12 disciples. During the next few days, we see a good deal of each other. There are interviews to be arranged with the newspaper men and lectures to be given to the Hindus of Paris. It is amazing to see how these spineless devils order one another about. Amazing also to see how ineffectual they are in all that concerns practical affairs. And the jealousy and the intrigues, the petty, sordid rivalries. Wherever there are 10 Hindus together, there is India, with her sects and schisms, her racial, lingual, religious, political antagonisms. In the person of Gandhi, they are experiencing for a brief moment the miracle of unity. But when he goes, there will be a crash, an utter relapse into that strife and chaos so characteristic of the Indian people. The young Hindu, of course, is optimistic. He has been to America, and he has been contaminated by the cheap idealism of the Americans, contaminated by the ubiquitous bathtub, the 5- and 10-cent store bric-a-brac, the bustle, the efficiency, the machinery, the high wages, the free libraries, etc., etc. His ideal would be to Americanize India. He is not at all pleased with Gandhi's retrogressive mania. Forward, he says, just like a YMCA man. As I listen to his tales of America, I see how absurd it is to expect of Gandhi that miracle which will deroute the trend of destiny. India's enemy is not England, but America. India's enemy is the time spirit, the hand which cannot be turned back. Nothing will avail to offset this virus which is poisoning the whole world. America is the very incarnation of doom. She will drag the whole world down to the bottomless pit. He thinks the Americans are a very gullible people. He tells me about the credulous souls who succored him there, the Quakers, the Unitarians, the Theosophists, the New Thoughters, the Seventh-day Adventists, etc. He knew where to sail his boat, this bright young man. He knew how to make the tears come to his eyes at the right moment. He knew how to take up a collection, how to appeal to the minister's wife, how to make love to the mother and daughter at the same time. To look at him, you would think him a saint. And he is a saint in the modern fashion, a contaminated saint who talks in one breath of love, brotherhood, bathtubs, sanitation, efficiency, etc. The last night of his sojourn in Paris is given up to the fucking business. He has had a full program all day, conferences, cablegrams, interviews, photographs for the newspapers, affectionate farewells, advice to the faithful, etc., etc. At dinner time, he decides to lay aside his troubles. He orders champagne with the meal, he snaps his fingers at the garçon, and behaves in general like the boorish little peasant that he is. And since he has had a bellyful of all the good places, he suggests now that I show him something more primitive. He would like to go to a very cheap place, order 2 or 3 girls at once. I steer him along the Boulevard de la Chapelle, warning him all the while to be careful of his pocketbook. Around Aubervilliers, we duck into a cheap dive. And immediately we've got a flock of them on our hands. In a few minutes he's dancing with a naked wench, a huge blonde with creases in her jowls. I can see her ass reflected 12 times in the mirrors that line the room, and those dark, bony fingers of his clutching her tenaciously. The table is full of beer glasses, the mechanical piano is wheezing and gasping. The girls who are unoccupied are sitting placidly on the leather benches, scratching themselves peacefully, just like a family of chimpanzees. There is a sort of subdued pandemonium in the air, a note of repressed violence, as if the awaited explosion required the advent of some utterly minute detail, something microscopic but thoroughly unpremeditated, completely unexpected. In that sort of half-reverie which permits one to participate in an event and yet remain quite aloof, the little detail which was lacking began obscurely but insistently to coagulate, to assume a freakish, crystalline form, like the frost which gathers on the windowpane. and like those frost patterns which seem so bizarre, so utterly free and fantastic in design, but which are nevertheless determined by the most rigid laws, so this sensation which commenced to take form inside me seemed also to be giving obedience to ineluctable laws. My whole being was responding.